Good morning. My name is Mike McNichols, and it's my privilege to be with you this morning. This really is a good story, you know. It's even found its way into pop culture a few times. I love stories. If you are an NPR listener like me, as I confess before you now, you know that on the weekend there's a lot of shows with stories attached to them. One of my favorites is one called This American Life with Ira Glass. He's one of my favorites. I like his show very much. Very recently, he did an interview with someone who's actually a friend of Todd's, a fellow named Jim Henderson. Jim is a Christian writer, blogger. And he connected with Ira Glass at a hotel in Tacoma, Washington. Jim had heard that Ira had made the comment somewhere along the way that he felt that Christians got a bad rap in the media. Glass went on to say that he'd had Christian friends, some who had come alongside him and helped him as he was trying to work through some very difficult reporting jobs in his life, and they were very helpful to him. He said they were kind and loving people. Yeah, they tried to convert him once in a while, but he didn't care. He knew it was because they liked him. It's interesting. Ira Glass is Jewish and also an atheist. And he said something to Jim that really, really struck me. After Jim asked him about his own life, he said, Ira, what about you? Have you found faith for yourself? And Glass very honestly said, no, I haven't. He said, I'm not against it. I'm not opposed to the idea of faith. He said, especially with you, you guys have the best story, he said. You Christians, you've got the best story in the whole world. I just can't find my life in it. And he said this, he said, it's kind of like loving someone and then suddenly discovering that you're not really in love with that person. You can't find that place within yourself that draws you into that deep sense of intimate love. And he says, for me, faith has been elusive in that way. I can't seem to find it for myself. And yet at the same time, he still admired the story that's right at the heart of our Christian faith. Well, he's right. We do have an amazing story. It's an incredible story. It's a story that begins with God right at the center of all things. And it ends with that same God recreating everything that has been destroyed and misused by the likes of all of us. It's a story that begins with the emergence of a world that expresses God's heart for the entire created order. And it's a world that's characterized by harmony rather than violence. It's a world where all living things coexist peacefully in the unhindered presence of God. If you've ever read the book of Genesis, you know that's how the story starts out. First two chapters, this pretty glorious stuff. Until you get to chapter 3, and then it all goes to smash, doesn't it? It all goes south very, very quickly as the human beings figure out how to play fast and loose with this very generous life that God has granted to the human race. And so for the next 8 chapters following that, there's this roller coaster ride of human beings trying to get everything back under their control. And it starts out with reproduction. The first people have children, because don't we all know that the next generation is going to do better? Instead, they invent jealousy and murder. And then a global flood washes everything away as people have expanded and evil has expanded with them. It's pervasive on the planet, and it's a kind of a do-over, leaving just a faithful remnant behind who come up with cursing and subjugation the minute their feet hit dry land. And then humans decide to celebrate their own ingenuity, their cleverness, by constructing a tower as a symbol of their greatness, one that reaches right up to the very heavens where certainly God might reside. And that ends in chaos and division. And so it seems hopeless. There doesn't seem to be any solution to this problem of a world that has gone awry, because most people would agree things are not as they should be. Something's gone terribly wrong with the world, and there does not seem to be any way to fix it. But in Genesis chapter 12, the solution to the problem is presented, but it is not presented through human ingenuity. There is no human cleverness that's going to resolve the situation. The solution does not come through a bunch of do-overs that try to reset the world, but instead it comes from the hand of God himself. God reaches out to this wandering nomad named Abram, and he offers this promise. God says, I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. This promise lays the groundwork for our story. Our story arises out of this promise. It's a story of destiny and purpose. It's a story that and a promise that is recaptured by Jesus when he tells his followers to go and make disciples of all nations. And it's a promise that provides us with the meaning of our place as a gathered people in a broken world. Well, the story that we heard this morning about Jacob and his dream, his vision of a ladder. Most scholars would say that the word that we translate as ladder is probably better translated as a ramp, an earthen ramp, perhaps even a staircase or a stairway to heaven. Somebody should write a song about that, Cindy. What do you think? See what we've done here? Well, this story contains the restating of that same promise that was offered up to Abram, one who would later be called Abraham. That was Jacob's ancestor. That promise was offered then. It's being offered once again in this dream. But there's been a lot of drama and a lot of intrigue between the giving of those two promises. And it appears, as we read the story very carefully, that Jacob has become disconnected from God's intentions for the world. And in that disconnection, he just might have put God into a box. You know, people who claim to believe in God sometimes express their own disconnection from God by reshaping him in a whole variety of ways. A few years ago, I saw a survey that was done in the United States about how Americans who believe in God actually see God, how they understand the character of God and his presence to people. And about a third of those who were surveyed said that they saw God as very authoritative, angry at the world, and yet very connected to human beings. Then about a quarter of the people surveyed said that they saw God much more as one who was benevolent and present and mostly positive about everything. And another quarter said that God was distant and uninterested in the world, much more of a kind of impersonal cosmic force than a personal deity, kind of a Star Wars-ish sort of a God, you might say. And then a much smaller group saw God as critical and angry, ready to exact punishment, but at the same time, very disconnected from the world. Now, I've never tested this out, but my guess is you could run that survey in the average church and get all kinds of images about the very character of God. Well, you know, this reshaping of God's character and essence is something that people do all the time. It's really nothing new. A loved one dies, and people seek to discover God's purposes in orchestrating this death for some greater and yet unknown good. Or life takes a very difficult turn, and people want to know, who was it along the way that missed God's will, maybe without even realizing it? Or a faithful church attender comes into some money, maybe even wins the lottery. And people say, well, how come that one was blessed and another was not? Because don't we all know that God's blessing always translates into money? Some of you would say, yes, it should. Well, and even those who do not consider themselves people of faith might craft God in the image of God's most ill-behaved children. People put God into a box all the time. And it may be that Jacob put God in a box. The image of this ramp or this staircase connecting to heaven to earth was not an entirely common mental image in the ancient Near East. The idea was that God or some preferred deity of some type would reside at the top of that ramp or that staircase. Sometimes that ramp was actually portrayed as a tower, maybe perhaps like the Tower of Babel even. And of course, if God's up there, people all navigate at ground level. And so it would be the job of human beings to somehow try to make their way up that ramp or that staircase to get in closer proximity to their deity. Now, this dream, however, would have been startling, most likely, to Jacob in at very least two ways. First, seeing this image of God's work and presence in this very desolate place where Jacob was trying to sleep with his head on a rock would have upset his thinking about the boundaries that God was supposed to be contained in. It's very likely that Jacob would have thought of God as the God of his father and of his grandfather, and as such, he needed to be territorial. He needed to hover around the land of Jacob's ancestors. And so when Jacob had departed his homeland, he might have thought that he left God behind as well. And so seeing this staircase, this ramp appearing far outside of Jacob's home territory would have challenged his assumption about God's locality. And second, in the very conventional thinking of the day, God was supposed to remain up at the top of that staircase. That's where God belongs, up in the clouds somewhere. And so Jacob could have been startled in a couple of ways. The first is to see God's angels, God's messengers moving up and down that ramp, moving from heaven to earth, involved in some fashion in the day-to-day activities of the human race. But even more importantly, when God speaks to Jacob, the Lord speaks to him as one who stands alongside another person, as one who is engaged and intimate, rather as one who is distant and unconcerned. And so Jacob expresses his surprise at all of this when he says, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it." You know, religion is a really handy tool for boxing God in, when you think about it. Christianity as well. We have to include ourselves in this mix and all of Christianity's variety of expressions, because religion as a structure provides rational frameworks, it provides shared practices, common expectations, and it does that so that people will have practices and language to have some understanding of something that transcends human rationality and experience. And so people will often look to religious systems to provide them with a sense of purpose and meaning, and also for a way to live a life that's worth living. And of course, the problem is that religious structures do not always provide freedom into living such a good life, but sometimes serve as blinders to what is truly good, and to limit our vision so that we don't really see how God might be present to us. You know, the people in Jesus' day were just as capable of boxing God in as we are. The Jewish people had this very strong religious tradition that they thought would order their lives so that one day God's blessing would finally come to them and they would be freed from their political and military oppression. But Jesus came along and challenged all of those expectations and showed the people that God indeed was not distant as they might have thought, not waiting to bless them once they jumped through all of the appropriate religious hoops or when they climbed the stairs of that proper staircase, but rather that God was fully present to them in real time. And that presence was demonstrated in the person of Jesus himself. Listen again to the words that we heard this morning, the words of Jesus when he says, "Come to me, get away with me, and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace." Now imagine hearing those words for the first time when you've ordered your life around your own religious or philosophical certainties and then found those certainties to be wanting. What would it be like to have all of your presuppositions about a distant, angry God challenged as you heard Jesus invite you to come to him and find rest? Imagine the shock that you might have at the contrast between your own mental frameworks and the idea of living in the unforced rhythms of grace. You know, for me, it's been interesting over the years to observe and, I confess, even participate in some of the influences that have shaped the church in our context, our culture, our country. 50 years ago, it'd be probably safe to say that churches were mostly formed by their denominational families, the distinctives that crafted their family of faith, their tribe of faith, so to speak. I remember when I was in the Navy, I was stationed in Florida for the first part of my time in the Navy, and I decided I had a Sunday off, I would go to church. And I had a friend who was Catholic. He'd never been in a Protestant church. He said he'd go with me, take a walk on the religious wild side, you know, and so we did. We hadn't even received our civilian clothes back yet. We're wearing Navy uniforms. Off we go to church. And it was a church that was part of the same denominational family as my home church right here in Southern California. So we show up at this church in Orlando, Florida in 1972. It was kind of eerie because it was so familiar. It reminded me during my boot camp times. We got a Sunday off and they put us on a bus and took us to Disney World, which was just being constructed, but they had Main Street done. And I was really homesick, wanting to see my sweetie. And I walked into Main Street and I thought, my gosh, I'm in Anaheim. I thought I could run to that payphone over there, some of you remember payphones, and put in a dime. You even remember dimes. And I could call her. I could be home in a half an hour. It's awesome. And it suddenly occurred to me, I'm thousands of miles away. It was creepy. Well, I walked into this church. It wasn't creepy, but it was eerily familiar. Same identical blue hymn books. Same hymns. Similar structure of the sermon that we heard. Similar culture of very kind people. A lady invited my friend and I home for Sunday dinner. Some of you remember Sunday dinner. It's the same kind of a meal my mom cooked on Sunday afternoons. And we went. It was glorious with her family. It was so nice. The building itself reminded me of my home church. I mean, everything was very familiar because in my denominational family, we had a way of doing things. And that's how we figured out who we were. But over the years, in an effort, I think in a noble effort in some ways, to reach out to a culture that's characterized by rapid change and a general disinterest in those denominational distinctives, as well as a disinterest in religion in general, churches have often looked to other frameworks, quite often from the worlds of business and entertainment, in order to shape their corporate life and influence. A book that many Christian leaders have read is a business book called Good to Great, by the business writer Jim Collins. And in the book, it's a very interesting book, Collins surveys companies that have just been adequate in their performance historically, but all of a sudden they just catapulted up into quantifiable greatness, measurable greatness by certain measures within the business world. And of course, why wouldn't church people be excited about this? Who wants to just motor along and be marginal? Don't you want to catapult to some sort of quantifiable greatness? So people gobbled this book up. Most pastors I talked to had it on their shelf right next to their Bible commentaries, seriously. But I saw him interviewed by Pastor Bill Hybels of the Willow Creek Giant Megachurch in Chicago on a simulcast thing. And Colin said something rather challenging. He said, yeah, I'm glad everybody's excited about this book, but you know it doesn't mostly apply to churches. And he wrote a little extra chapter, called it a monograph, and it was called Good to Great and the Social Sector, which is about nonprofits, including churches. And he says that in the profit world, you have to think this way. Money runs the business machine, and money is the measure of its success. Doesn't matter what great product you produce, if you don't have profit at the end of the year, you're probably on the road to failure. And that's how it's measured. In the nonprofit world, including our little world, you do have to spend some money. You got to pay some rent. You got to pay some salaries. It costs money to get people gathered in the same place over and over. But money is not the measure of success in that world. Collins says the measure of success is how true the organization has been to its mission. Now, I've had the pleasure of speaking to pastor groups from here to Australia. And I'll ask a whole room of 30, 50 pastors, how many of you have read Good to Great? Oh, yeah, hands through the air. How many of you picked up the little $10 monograph that follows it? Maybe 3 out of 50? Word has not quite gotten out, I don't think. I'm not bashing the business world. I worked for a long time in it. I worked 14 years in the business world, and I loved it. I loved the challenge. I loved the pacing, the strategies, the excitement. And yes, I got stressed out a lot. And yes, there were a lot of sleepless nights and a lot of weekends I had to work on stuff. But it was the most challenging thing I'd ever done up to that point in my life before I left and became a pastor. But I'll tell you one thing. I would never characterize that world as having unforced rhythms of grace. That's just not how businesses make money. And too often, life in the Christian community is shaped by the same patterns of frantic activity that characterize our culture at large. And I want to be clear about this. I'm not a culture basher at all. Cultures are constantly emerging and changing. And to try to somehow cut ourselves off from our culture because of our Christian convictions is, first of all, impossible, and secondly, ill-advised. Because every culture, including the variety of cultures we find in the United States, every culture is a context for ministry. Every culture. And so as followers of Jesus, we seek to learn what God is doing all around us and in the most unexpected circumstances. But at the same time, we seek to be a people formed more by the Spirit of God than by the often capricious forces of cultural preference. When Jesus told people to come away with him, to walk with him, to work with him, they could literally do that. And some did. Left their nets, followed after Jesus, hung around with him for a long time. But it's different for us, isn't it? We do not have that literal response that his first followers would have enjoyed. And yet we're still invited to join our lives to Jesus. And when we do, we realize that we are being immersed in the most amazing story ever offered to the human race. It's the story of the God who creates and rescues. The God who is not us, but who is present with us, among us, and even in us. It's the story of the God who does not isolate himself at the top of a cosmic staircase and then challenge us to struggle our way to the top, but instead comes alongside us and reveals to us his character in and through the person of Jesus. It's the story that offers a way and a hope of a life of unforced rhythms of grace, a life that's expressed in the midst of a very tragic, broken, and frantic world. You know, in various ways, we've all put God in a box. I know I have, over time and time again, different boxes for different times of my life. We've created mental boundaries where God has got to reside and stay put. And as a result, some of us have suffered with cases of spiritual insecurity or with religious certainties that have kept us in while keeping others out. I think we all wrestle with these things from time to time. But the story into which we've been invited is one that is generous and life-giving. It's a story about us, and yet it's about us for the sake and blessing of the world. The God of our story is indeed mysterious and majestic, and yet that same God comes alongside us in intimacy and love. The God of our story comes to us in the person of Jesus. In the midst of all of our boundaries, all of our misunderstandings, he looks us in the eye and invites us to come to him and to recover our lives. And my hope this morning, for any folks who are here today who are feeling that sense of disconnection that I've been referring to today, that as you hear that, you would come away today saying, indeed, that the Lord is in this place, even though I didn't know it. And he comes alongside you to affirm that in your life. Amen.